Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Radha Madhava Hari. Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are reading Canto 10, Chapter 10, and there are two verses for today, so text 11 and text 12. I'll read text 11 and then proceed to text 12, which is on the board and is the text that has a purport. So text 11. Deha kimana davasvam. Next one we'll chant together because that's the one on the board, 12. Ashek tur mature vacha matu pitu. Va valina kretur agne suno pivam. And the translation for text 11. While alive, does this body belong to his employer, to the self, to the father, the mother, or the mother's father? Does it belong to the person who takes it away by force, to the slave owner, who purchases it, or to the sons who have it, who burn it in the fire? Or if the body is not burnt, does it belong to the dogs that eat it? Among the many possible claimants, who is the rightful claimant? Not to ascertain this, but instead to maintain the body by sinful activities is not good. And text 12, which we can chant together. Evam sadaranam deham avyakta prabhavyapyayayam kovidvan atma vad kritva. Nanti jantumrite sataha evam sadaranam deham avyakta prabhavyapyayam kovidvan amasat kritva. Hanti yantamrite sataha svam sadaranam deham avyakta prabhavya piyayam kovidvan atmasat kritva. Hanti jantun rite sataha. Please chant. Evam sadaranam deham. Yeah, probably. Evam sadaranam devam akritya prabhavaya payam kovidvan atmasatkritvam anti jantum rite sata evam sadaranam deham Abhyakta prabhavai pilam Kovidvan atmasakritvam Hanti jantun rite sataham. And the word for word, evam, in this way, adaranam, sorry, common property. Deham, the body, avyakta, from unmanifested nature, prabhava, manifested in that way, apyayam, and again merged with the unmanifest, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. Ka, who is that person? Vidvan, one who is actually knowledge. Atmasat Kritva, claiming as his own. Hanti, kills. Jatin. Oh, it's with you, sorry. Spelt it wrong. Jatun, poor animals. Rite, except. Asataha, rascals who have no knowledge, no clear understanding. Okay, and the purport. So text 12, translation. This body, after all, is produced by the unmanifested nature and again annihilated and merged in the material elements. Therefore, it is the common property of everyone. Under the circumstances, who but a rascal claims this property as his own? And while maintaining it, commits such sinful activities as killing animals just to satisfy his whims. Unless one is a rascal, one cannot commit such sinful activities. Purport. Atheists do not believe in the existence of the soul. Nonetheless, unless one is very cruel, why should one kill animals unnecessarily? The body is a manifestation of a combination of matter. In the beginning, it was nothing, but by a combination of matter, it has come into existence. Then again, when the combination is dismantled, the body will no longer exist. In the beginning, it was nothing, and in the end, it will be nothing. Why then should one commit sinful activities when it is manifested? It is not possible for anyone to do this unless he is rascal number one. Om Gyana Timurandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manopistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Pandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamlam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sham Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ragunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishaka Vitam Sham Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavan Ishwari Shabanasute Devi Pranamami Hari Priya Panchakalpatrubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Devacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnebhyo Namo Namaha Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Rama Padaswami Iti Namine Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nivishesha Sunyavadi Paschita Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. So, in text 11, Narada Muni is raising a very important question. So the question he's raising is, who is it that one's body belongs to? He gives various options as possible owners. firstly, there's the employer, the person or business firm who has hired one to work for a salary. So by virtue of being hired or one's body being hired, it becomes the possession of the person or firm extracting labor from the body. A second option is that the body belongs to the self, or oneself as distinct from others, so it's the self. and of course, since we're a group of spiritualists, we understand the self a little different, not merely the self separate from others, but rather the self can be understood according to the distinction that Lord Krishna makes in Bhagavad Gita, where he says that the body is something that becomes non-existent, and the soul is that is eternal. So the soul being the self, that which is eternal. So from the perspective of spiritualists, so I'm going on a little diversion because it's not inbuilt in Narada Muni's question, but he mentioned, does it belong to the self? So I'm just looking at self from two perspectives. so the second perspective, because the body is changing at every moment, because of the action and reaction of cells that are going on, the different cells, then because the soul is existing permanently, remaining the same despite the changes of the body, then the soul could be considered to be the owner of the body. So these are Krishna's words that highlight this distinction so that we can understand self better. He says, those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of births. So that's from Bhagavad Gita 2.16. So Narada Muni carries on because he's raising this really important question: who does the body belong to? So the next option he gives is that there's a in terms of the possibility of who's the owner of the body. So he offers the possibility of it being the father. So after all, the father has engendered the child or one's body, but the question still remains, and this is a question that Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur puts in words. He says, is this wealth, the svam, which was in text 11, the wealth, is it the wealth of the father, this body that one has, or is it of the mother, or the father of the mother? So, you know, you can't merely look at the immediate person who's engendered one. There's always the person who engendered that person. So it gets complex. And so this idea is problematic because Srila Prabhupada, he puts it this way. One is caused by one's father, and he in turn is caused by his father and his grandfather. So, you know, it's a whole sequence, meaning the grandfather is caused by his father. So, so in many room conversations, you find Srila Prabhupada highlighting that particular point. So other possibilities that are there of whom the body belongs to, and that's offered by Narada Muni, is he looks at in connection to when the body is lost. Maybe that gives us some sort of clue as to who the body belongs to. So in the beginning, you know, he's looking at, you know, how the body is coming into being, so to speak, or how it's manifesting, and maybe that gives you some idea of who the owner or the proper claimant of the body is. Now he's looking at when the body's lost, maybe that gives you an idea of who the claimant is. So the question that's asked by Narada is, if the body belongs to the sons, or is it that the body belongs to the sons who burn that body at death? Because after all, you could say they're claiming it, because now they're going to decide what happens with that body. They're going to burn it or not, but if they're the ones who are burning it, does the body actually belong to them? Alternately, if the body isn't being burned, does this mean that the dogs who come and eat it actually are the proper claimants of that body? They can claim that body as theirs because now they've got access to that body as their foodstuff. He finally ends by asking this question, Narada Muni. Among the many possible elements, who is the rightful claimant? Still, it's not clear. And Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, when he's looking at these questions posed by Narada, and he's commenting on this particular verse, he says that in particular, this verse, where this question is being looked at, is who is the proper claimant for the body? He says that actually the verse shows the many contradictions that arise, and why those contradictions are arising is because in looking at who's the or trying to understand who's the rightful claimant of the body, there's a certain concept that's been held, and we're going to come to that in a minute. So Narada himself gives a reason for why there's this all these contradictions. And also he gives a reason for why it's necessary that you have to identify who the body belongs to. Because if one knows who the body belongs to, that affects the manner in which the body is maintained. So, if it's not resolved, the first problem of identifying whom the body belongs to, then using a means to maintain the body through sinful activities is not good, as he puts it. So it seems it's very necessary to first identify who the body belongs to, because that's going to affect how one maintains it. And even until you know that, if you are just maintaining it by sinful means, it's not good. So this is Narada's, how he's looking at things. So logically, Narada continues looking at this problem of how the body comes to exist. So in text 12, the text that we chanted together, he says, okay, the body is produced by the unmanifest nature and again annihilated and merged into the natural elements. So you could learn that from the first verse. You know, it's coming into existence and then, you know, it's ceasing to exist. So he says, okay, it's coming from nature, it's getting annihilated, and again it's returning to its natural elements. So you can understand that much. And Srila Prabhupada, he refers to material nature as actually making the body under the direction of super soul. So we've just seen the external, but behind that, material nature is actually putting those elements together, but it's under the direction of super soul. And there's, this is from Bhagavad Gita 13:30, where Krishna is saying, Prakritaiva cha karmani kriyamanani sarvasa yat pasyati tatatmanam akartaram sarpasyati. So the architect of the body is material nature. It's building the body. And the Lord, or the super soul, is the designer of the body. He decides how those elements will be put together. And then the activities of the body, what the body can do, are such that when those elements are put together, according to how the Supreme Lord is designing it, and that body is forced to perform those activities. And those activities could be making one happy or unhappy because of how the body is made up. So the Lord is designing it in a particular way, meaning that there's also, at least in the case of a human body, the design includes the mind and the ego and the intelligence. So it's also designed in a particular way so that whatever one's forced to do, it's going to bring happiness or distress, but it's been designed specifically because it's also coming from something before that, and we'll come to that in a minute. Because the particular body is created according to one's own past desires. So there's design, but it's coming from the things that the living being is desiring from a previous body. It's carried through, at least this is from the on the human level, it's carried through into the subtle body. So that subtle design is made in such a way so that those desires can be acted on. So, you know, within the mind will be stored all the desires and also the karmic actions and reactions that have to come with that body from the previous life's activities. So it's such a subtle design. It's like a perfect package that takes into account the personal desires and also what one is has to go through in one's life. So thus, in conclusion, Due to the body being created by nature, and due to its remaining or returning to nature, it actually has one's own body shares a common origin with every other body, because they're all coming from the same source. And so, for this reason, because the origin of the body, those material elements, the Lord designing it, for this reason, you could say that the body is actually the common property of everyone, because everybody is coming from the same source. This is the by logic how the argument has gone that's been presented here. So it's very interesting. It started out with very specific, but it actually extends to that the body is the common property of everyone. Very interesting. One doesn't think, oh, my body belongs to everybody. Usually one wants to claim it, or at least see my body's different from that body. But actually, because of the common composition, it's common property of everyone. So from the spiritual perspective, that has implications because of how one's going to come to use the body in service of everyone because of that common understanding. So Lord Krishna explains this conclusion in the following way, meaning that the body is the common property of everyone. So he gives an explanation for how this kind of view can be held, so that one comes to hold a spiritual concept of life versus a material concept. So the material concept is the concept where one is looking for ownership. You know, who does this body belong to? Me, my father, my mother, the father of my mother, the dogs are going to eat the body, the person that I'm working for, who does the body belong to? That's actually looking from a material concept. Where one's looking for ownership of the body, or by trying to claim the body either at its inception or at its death. So this is still looking from with the material concept. Instead, to understand that after the body is destroyed, the spirit soul, going back to Lord Krishna's distinction, because remember, he made a distinction between the body and the soul, the eternal part of what's within the body. So going back to the distinction, one could say that there's actually a common identity as Brahman or spirit. So that's actually the common identity. So the material concept, okay, the body actually is the common property of everyone. That's what the conclusion is through looking at everything. From the spiritual perspective, the common identity is as spirit soul, as Brahman or spirit. So having looked at the nature of the body, meaning the composition and the directive for its creation, one comes back to the next point that's raised by Narada Muni. And this point is also voiced by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur when he's looking at this verse. And this is how the words are: who but an ignorant person, asataha, that's the word, that's the last line in the verse, one who has, and it's translated as one who has no clear understanding, who but such a person can accept such a body as one's own? So one has to be completely ignorant, completely lacking in knowledge. You haven't even thought it through, which is what Narada was trying to help us look. Even from the material concept, you haven't thought it through of, you know, who can claim ownership of this body. So so you have to be completely ignorant or lacking knowledge, not to have examined this question in the first place and also come to the proper conclusion. So the clear understanding, it's voiced by Lord Krishna. So these are Lord Krishna's words. When a sensible man, no, it's sensible, ceases to see different identities due to different material bodies, and he does not, and he sees how beings are expanded everywhere, he attains to the Brahman conception. So it gives you an idea of how you can come to this point where you can actually see that the common identity of everyone as spirit has to do with coming to a point where you're not actually seeing the different external forms. rather, you're not even saying, oh, there's a parrot, or there is a wren, or there is a rat. Rather, one is seeing that common identity. Oh, somebody also who's a spirit soul. also, one can see that spirit is expanded everywhere. I mean, it's encased in particular bodies, but it's expanded everywhere. So that is the clear understanding one needs to come to. This is how Lord Krishna is putting it. So that was from Bhagavad Gita 13:31. So when one can see that the spirit soul, in contact with material nature, gets different types of bodies, he's obtained spiritual vision. So that's the background part. being able to look with spiritual vision means that one is able to see that it's just because of contact with material nature that the spirit soul is then getting the arrangement being made for a particular type of body. So Satyaraj, a very nice devotee, when I was a very young devotee, he used to be coming to the Brooklyn Temple. So he's written many, many, many books. And he often deals with, I guess, these symposiums where other religionists are discussing topics. So his books are always from the perspective of examining different religious traditions and how understanding of different concepts is there. So he has a particular book called Diet for Transcendence. So he puts it that the Vedic vision of spirituality is not limited to the human form, and followers of the Vedas identify neither themselves nor any other living creature with the external body. Rather, they see the same eternal soul within each bodily shell, imbued with the same spiritual perfection. So these are his words, and he's writing to a very large audience of religionists. So this is the spiritual vision. One's not looking at merely that external form of the body. So one's operating with the spiritual vision by seeing that even that rat, that parrot, they have the eternal soul within that shell of their body, be it a small shell, a big shell. So here Srila Prabhupada, he's noting in the purport that atheists do not believe in the existence of the soul. So there's a category of human beings that will not look with the spiritual vision. And it even gets more subtle. And Satyaraj, he points to a particular hypocrisy that's there, where somebody claims to be a religionist, while they're adhering to a vision, because they can't sense the existence of the soul, and they can't sense the existence of the soul in other creatures, then they think nothing of feasting on slaughtered creatures, because they can't sense the existence of the soul. And these may be religionists who are functioning in this way. So they claim that the creatures have life, but they've got no soul because they can't sense it, they can't perceive it. Because how can one perceive or how can one develop spiritual vision? One has to hear about it from Bhagavad Gita. If you haven't heard or if your scriptures don't teach that, then you're not going to be perceiving it. Because perceiving means you're looking with some knowledge. Last Sunday I was doing a class with the children because we're doing Ramayan, or one group of children that I'm teaching at the moment, the 8 to 10 year olds. And one of the themes that was very prominent in the section we were dealing with, and I pointed it out to them, that when you're looking, are you looking just at what you see, or are you observing what you see, or are you observing what you have knowledge of? You know, because there's a difference, you know? And this was, because the children are extremely intelligent, they come to a point where, you know, one can point out such themes to them and they comprehend. So this is exactly that thing, that religionists, they actually can be just looking at observing what they see. So it's that material concept. You're just looking at externally. And they're not actually observing with knowledge. So then if you're looking just with material concept, then you see, okay, there's life, but there's no soul. And so because of this kind of materialistic vision, you know, you just reduce life to biological concepts. Like, okay, there's bones and there's flesh and, you know, there's a circulatory system and there's a response to stimuli. It just becomes biological. And I know from going through a whole school system, that was the view that was held. I mean, even at university, that's the view that's held. I mean, you do any class that looks at biological functioning, it's purely biological. There's no mention of any other thing that drives anything. There's no mention of what it is that's animating the body. You know, you merely look at the chromosome structure that was inherited from parents and or grandparents, and then which genes are prominent that will increase the likelihood that you're going to have the same hair color as the mother or the same hair color as father. It's very biological. Nothing about the animation that gives life to that combination of DNA and the circulatory system or the nervous system. So because this is the case, that the materialistic vision of life is reducing everything to biological functioning, persons who hold this kind of view, they can't see the contradiction. And this, in our society, this is so prominent. They can't see the contradiction between pampering a pet. Like, I mean, if you go out onto the street, there's innumerable people taking their dogs for walks. And they're dutifully carrying their little plastic bag. They're going to, you know, take care of the excrement of the creature, pampering the creature. The creature will come home and there'll be a nice cushion and a nice basket for the creature to rest in. They can't see the contradiction between pampering one living creature as a pet and turning into a cannibal at the dinner table. I mean, they don't see a contradiction. You know, one is very loving to one body form, but the other body form is, you know, in some sort of charred state that one's going to consume. They don't see a contradiction. so there's no consciousness of spirit. And these, maybe many are religionists. I mean, I recall from personal experience, because I have an uncle who's a cardinal in the Catholic Church. When I was a teenager, I was sent to go and spend some time with him, and I thought, how can a religionist be eating meat? So it can't be possible. And I was very suspicious of whether he actually was a religionist, because I couldn't understand how is it possible. So there is a contradiction, and it's because of holding this material concept, this biological view of bodies. So in fact, persons with this kind of view, they actually are blissfully unaware of the simple activities they're committing, completely unaware. And sometimes I've found, even with such persons, if one brings it to their attention, they may even say, I don't want to know, because it means a whole change of life, a whole change of thinking. I mean, it's a huge undertaking, so they prefer not going down that road. So Srila Prabhupada asks the question, unless one is very cruel, why should one kill animals unnecessarily? So this is a very important question, because it seems very obvious. So mundane religionists, they can be seen as lacking moral keenness. So there isn't a keen moral sense of what's right and what's wrong. And even simple compassion hasn't awoken in them. They're not even getting sickened by the cruelty, because they're endorsing this terrible carnivorous activity in human society. It's very extreme. I mean, if you think that persons who are even claiming to be religionists, or even in positions as religionists, that they're lacking even a moral sense, it's odd. Such persons, they actually remain unaware that the creature that they're blithely going to eat has actually endured unspeakable suffering in the slaughterhouse. There was a magazine I used to get, because I don't like reading newspapers, and so the magazine would be journalists looking at particular areas in society and doing a lot of research, and I found it very interesting. And one particular article was dealing with slaughterhouses, I think in Texas. So that suffering that, you know, one can't imagine. There was a description of people that were doing that work day in and day out of slaughtering those cattle that come from ranches in Texas. And the horrific thing was that they actually had a set number of minutes in which they needed to skin the animal. And everything was being timed. So the interesting thing was, because of the nature of that work, these persons trying to work fast, they were actually ending up also cutting themselves. So many of them were all like, damaged bodies because of the work they were doing. So it was coming back to them somehow. Anyway, a very horrific, I mean, just visualizing the process, and sometimes in their speed, the animal would still be alive when they started the skinning. So completely horrific. I mean, it's incomprehensible, the horror of it. And there was description also of places where hogs are killed and entire rooms being filled with blood, because, you know, it has to drain off somewhere. So anyway, reality, I mean, one can't even imagine it fully, and one doesn't even want to, but it is a reality. So So that spiritual vision that brings greater understanding and knowledge is given in Bhagavad Gita 13:33. Those with the vision of eternity can see that the imperishable soul is transcendental, eternal, and beyond the modes of nature. Despite contact with the material body, O Arjuna, the soul neither does anything nor is it entangled. So that spiritual vision that even with the external activity, the soul is still not doing anything. It isn't being caught up in any of these activities that one is performing. And the same thing applies to that slaughterhouse worker. The soul isn't actually doing anything. So spiritual vision allows one to see that by nature all entities are full of bliss, and because that's the nature of the soul, it's blissful. So it means every living entity is full of bliss. So sometimes it's hard to see, like at the end of winter when spring comes, sometimes I see the rabbits coming out and they look so tortured, like very skinny, and the fur is mottled. And you know, one thinks they must have gone through so much suffering. But actually, the truth of the matter is that as spirit souls, they're full of bliss. That's the truth of the matter. The soul is eternally blissful. So it doesn't matter what the external suffering may be. And there's a description that helps to bear this out. It's when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he actually is traveling through the Jarakanda forest. So this is the description. Here's one of them. When the Lord passed through the jungle in great ecstasy, packs of tigers, elephants, rhinoceros, and boars came, and the Lord passed through them. So he's chanting, and the creatures come to him. So it wasn't, you know, one or two creatures, but the entire pack of rhinoceros came, the entire pack of tigers. So they all were drawn to the chanting of the holy name. So that indicates that blissful nature, be it in the tiger body or in the rhinoceros or the boar, they came in packs to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he just walked through them. So I think he had a companion, I think it was Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya maybe, I don't know. His companion was terrified seeing packs of these wild animals coming. But they were responding, their blissful nature, that spirit soul was responding to the chanting of the holy name. That's why they were coming. So there's a tremendous graphic example of that blissful nature being present even in these super wild animals. And this is from Chaitanya Madhya 1726, that description. And there's a further description that one day, this is also from the Madhya Lila, one day a tiger was lying on the path. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, walking along the path in ecstatic love, touched the tiger with his foot. And the Lord said, so he addressed the tiger directly, chant the holy name of Krishna. And this is the description. The tiger immediately got up and began to dance and to chant, Krishna, Krishna. So one imagines a tiger becoming alert, but then actually that the sound coming out of his mouth is Krishna, Krishna. Just by being touched. So that indicates that blissful nature that's there. It just needed to be awakened. So, and there's another description. On another day, while Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was bathing in a river, a herd of maddened elephants came there to drink water. While the Lord was bathing and murmuring the Gayatri Mantra, the elephants came before him. The Lord immediately splashed some water on the elephants and asked them to chant the name of Krishna. So he's seen the spirit soul. He addresses them, and they're in a maddened state. So it doesn't describe why they're in a maddened state, but it was a herd. So not one, a whole herd, and all maddened. And he addresses them, please chant. So, So Lord Chaitanya was seeing no difference between a tiger, an elephant, or even a scholar, because prior to that he'd just been instructing a scholar. I think it was Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya in this section of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So advancing in spiritual consciousness means that one has really seen every living entity as an eternal part and parcel of the Lord. I hadn't been reading this, but twice a week I walk home, so I have to pass the graveyard, and for some reason all the flying duck or geese, I don't know the exact name, they're very large bodies. They all come there to, I guess, eat. Maybe it's an undisturbed space, and maybe there's, I don't know, whatever creatures are in the grass. So there's usually a lot of them. So when I walk past, it's great fun to start saying the Maha Mantra very loud. There's nobody around. It's a very deserted path. So I always say the Maha Mantra very loud, and all the geese turn their heads. It's not that one, you know, ignores. Every one of them turns around to hear. So, you know, it's the spirit soul is there, it's blissful. There's the blissfulness is aroused, they have to hear. So every one of them turns. Lord Krishna puts it this way: I'm seated in everyone's heart, and from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. So the great devotee, he knows that Krishna is within the heart of everyone. Because remember, super soul, earlier on in the discussion, Krishna in the heart, super soul, he's the architect of the body. So he actually is present within the heart of every living entity. And he's dictating what the living entity must follow. So these are... the words, how Srila Prabhupada paraphrases what Super Soul is dictating. So Super Soul is dictating. Here is a Mahabhagavat. Do not disturb him. So this was the case with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So even in that case, the spirit soul is there. Super Soul, who is was the architect of the body and who's present within the heart, also dictates to the particular creature what they must do. This is Srila Prabhupada's commentary. And so the super soul is saying to the maddened elephant, it's saying to the tiger who's lying on the path, it's saying it to those herds of rhinoceros or tigers that are coming towards Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. This is a Mahabhagavat, do not disturb him. So they get the message from within of how they must behave. So of course, in addition, the creatures in the forest, they got inspired to express their own love of Krishna. Because we hear that they actually are like the tigers, Krishna, Krishna. So indeed, great souls, they can understand this distinction between the body and the soul very perfectly. And they truly come to know that the living entity is eternal. And in spite of his being in that material body, he knows that the being is transcendental and eternal. And so this is the person who, by being able to see the spirit in every living entity, whether it's a human or a tiger, an elephant or a rhinoceros, that person actually possesses knowledge. So that's the opposite. Here we were hearing about the persons, the whole first text was the persons who are looking with material concept. The second verse, the one we're doing today, I've tried to elaborate a little. Who's that person with knowledge? So this kind of knowledge of being able to see the spirit soul within is in the mode of goodness. So even though there's different bodies, one can see that there's a superior nature of the Supreme Lord that's can be aroused in that living entity, and being able to seen this way is functioning in goodness. So those are some thoughts on these two particular verses. So if there's anything to expand our discussion.
I like that one story, like when you are chanting Hare Krishna mantra, all the ducks. It's very inspiring. I will also try once. I may also try once. Nice class.
I mean, Krishna's going to attempt it.
Hare Krishna Masaji, thank you for your class. You made a lot of wonderful points. One that my common question is related to the points you made of the really beautiful point that you made of asking the children, are you observing what you see? Or are you observing what you have knowledge of? Which I thought was a very profound point. And before I address that, it's kind of in my question, but basically, my whole comment and questions related to that point. I'll kind of roundabout come back to that point. But in this purport, it mentions in this verse and purport, it mentions atheists and I believe, right? Oh yeah, Prabhupada mentions atheists who do not believe in the existence of a soul or a supreme controller, So one thing that came to mind, because this verse refers, and this purport refers to atheists and also the killing of animals. And one thing that came to mind is maybe something most people have a concern with religion in this regard, is that we see that atheist means there's no controller. I'm in control. But throughout the scriptures, we see many people who worship Krishna also kind of had the same mentality, like, because controller means just like Indra, he thought he was the controller because he thought he had control over who lives and who dies in the Govardhan Lila. But then when Krishna humbled him, he realized, I'm actually not in control. And so sometimes in our life, we also feel that we have control over whose reputation lives, whose reputation dies, etc. But we see that, you know, the Hare Krishna movement flourished, for example, despite the newspapers and media criticizing it. Like Prabhupada's disciple said, the media is criticizing us. Prabhupada was like, great, free publicity. Everyone loves things that are forbidden. That's how the Hare Krishna movement expands. So they actually had no control over the Hare Krishna reputation. Krishna used the demons to spread the movement of Krishna consciousness. And so one pastime I kind of like to refer in this regard is that Durvasa Muni, he also thought he had control over who lives and who dies when he tried to kill Ambarish Maharaj. So Lord Vishnu essentially told Durvasa Muni, you may have the outfit of a spiritualist, but you don't have the infit of a spiritualist. Your celibacy and your vegetarianism kinds of can't, your attempt to commit homicide kind of cancel out your celibacy and your vegetarianism. What is the use of it if you're going to commit murder? And so we see throughout the history of mankind and religion, people also see very horrible things. Oh, you're a vegetarian, but you committed pedophilia, or you committed homicide. So many very things. And I feel like, that's why people have no, a lot of people become atheists because of religionists. That's one reason. And regarding your point of seeing through the eyes of knowledge, there's a really nice quote by Buddha that I really appreciate in this regard to Durvasa Muni, because also in the pastime, I'll just mention this one other pastime, in the pastime of Bhrigu Muni, and where he tested all three deities, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. They were all known throughout the universe as great spiritualists, but Bhrigu Muni wanted to test them. You have the outfit of a great spiritualist, but do you have the infit? So I'm going to give you a Bhakti Sastri exam. Not with the pen, pencil, and paper, but by ignoring you, by insulting you, and by attacking you. And only Vishnu passed the infit. There's a nice quote that says, if my shoes were made of humility, my dress of respect, my hat of determination, and my perfume of compassion, then I would be dressed for success. And in the Bible it says, one should clothe themselves with humility, tolerance, and forgiveness, and over above this, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. So anyone could be have the outfit of a spiritualist. Anyone can act like a spiritualist when we're honored, but try being a spiritualist when you're dishonored. So that's the real testament. That's the real Bhakti Sastri. And you were mentioning this, seeing through the eyes of knowledge. So in regular school, we take our exams very seriously, you know, because if we don't have a Bhakti Sastri exam, nobody asks us, do you have a Bhakti Sastri exam? You're like, no, it's not a big deal, but do you have a college degree? We become very ashamed. You know, I don't have a college degree. People take their prestige very seriously. Or, you know, to get a job, because without, you know, taking, you know, these college exams very seriously, we think we can't get a job, a proper job. At the same time, we don't take the Gyan Shakshusha, seeing through the eyes of knowledge, very seriously, because it's almost like a voluntary thing. And there's a quote by Buddha that's related to the Devasamuni pastime. It says, let no man think lightly of evil, saying in his heart, it will not come upon me. Even by the falling of water drops, a water pot is filled. The fool becomes full of evil, even if he gather it little by little. And we see on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, TV, how are they responding to circumstances? By insulting each other and counter-insulting each other. And some of the jokes are very funny, but they actually won't help you in your spiritual life. So what are some steps we can move forward to take our Bhakti Sastri exams? Not the one with the pen and paper, that won't help us either, but the one where Krishna gives us a test by testing our humility in practical life. When things don't go our way, when people mistreat us, when people disagree with us, when people insult us. So what are some steps we can move forward to take our, you know, because I'll speak for myself, and I know all the devotees throughout the years, we may not kill somebody, but we hope somebody gets injured for offending me. You know, I'm a great Vaishnava and they offended me, so I hope they get in the car, so I hope they get hurt. And we can see it on the most material nation. We have a very demoniac mentality. We spread rumors. We criticize each other. So what are some steps we can move forward to before Krishna humbles us, just like in so many pastimes, including as well, Nalakuvana Manigriva. So what are some steps we can move forward to take our real Bhakti Sastri seriously, like we take our material school seriously?
So the question was on looking at being an authentic spiritualist. being an authentic spiritualist, because I'm connecting it to the topic of today, as you were describing it, is somebody having shoes of humility and a fragrance of compassion and a hat of determination. So this is certainly the case that these are determination is the very much present in the life of a spiritualist, because it's essential for functioning consistently, having determination, and certainly compassion has to be there. And on the broad level, that compassion, at least in relation to today's topic, has been you know, vegetarianism is certainly part of that compassion. You cannot not have vegetarianism be there and be a compassionate person. I mean, it's that's hypocrisy. So those two aspects of your description of a spiritualist, they seem pretty straightforward. And then the one that is causing trouble that you were highlighting a lot is the mentality part, where there may actually be some direct effort to harm others within one because one has got hurt. So with any with anything that comes from the outside, one has to take shelter of knowledge. So if one's taking shelter of knowledge, then one sees things differently. So if by some chance somebody expressed something to one that caused pain to one, one's mind may be disposed already to a particular kind of sensitivity. So not everything will hurt one. One person will be hurt if they're ignored. Another person won't be hurt if they're ignored. It's how one's mind has already been designed. or one person may be hurt by somebody's anger, but another person will not be bothered by anger. So it all has to do with how one's mind is designed, you know, what one is sensitive to. So over time, one can recognize the patterns of one's mind, what, you know, how one's mind processes things. One can start to recognize that. So that's part of being a spiritualist, coming to understand the patterns of one's functioning. So when you start to understand your own personal pattern, then you use the knowledge, the spiritual knowledge you have, to help yourself. So one recognizes, okay, if I am ignored, I'm going to feel hurt. Means I'm not acknowledged as an entity. Then, you know, one speaks to oneself, because it's work only one can do for oneself. So one speaks to oneself and says, well, I'm based on spiritual teachings, I'm actually a spirit soul. My mind is very sensitive to being ignored, but that's not who I am. I'm not that this body. I understand that my mind is very sensitive to being ignored, but I know that I'm very happy serving Krishna, and I'm happy serving devotees. And in this particular case, I would have preferred to have been acknowledged. My mind is sensitive to that. Let me shed a few tears and let me go on. You know, what's she going to do? That's a pattern in the mind. Or the pattern in the mind may be one where one responds with anger. If, you know, let's say it was being ignored, so different minds function differently. So one, another mind, instead of being hurt, is going to want to lash out. So in that particular case, again, one has to speak to oneself, because one can't actually lash out. It's not proper etiquette, certainly not with the devotee of Lord Krishna as spiritualist. One wouldn't lash out because one has the knowledge, oh, it's a pattern in the mind. It's a pattern in the mind. How can I now make somebody else suffer through my anger? Let me take responsibility for the pattern in my own mind. So it's arousing anger. I don't want to lash out at somebody. Let me leave the room. Let me go and take a brisk walk. Let me shout out. Let me scream into the ether. But let me spare that devotee my anger. Because it's a pattern in my mind. One's looking with knowledge. One knows that's the pattern in the mind. That's the way the mind is wired to respond. But you know, with intelligence, it's not the correct thing to do with a spiritualist, because the spiritualist will see, oh, that's a pattern in that person's mind. So they're not going to be touched by it, but it's not proper etiquette on the part of oneself to do that. So one keeps a check on oneself, like a strict check.
Prabhupada also says that we shouldn't disturb sentient beings.
And when we expect, like say we expect bad behavior coming from people in the mode of ignorance and the mode of passion. But when somebody's claiming to be a devotee, you know, there's Vaishnava behavior. So you know, you don't really go to that, bending your, you know what I'm saying? You control yourself around devotees, right? I mean, Prabhupada said, he said, this devotee left, you made it so bad for him, he'll never want to come back. So, I mean, we have to take those things into consideration. People have feelings, you know, and they say forgive and forget, but we say, I've heard it say, forgive, but don't forget. Because if you forget, then you're going to might fall into that pattern again. So, you know, it seems to be hypocritical if a person claims to be a devotee, but at the same time abusive. And when they, when there is abuse, you just kind of vacate the situation because you don't want it to happen again. And that person is perpetuating more anarthas within himself.
Yes.
So does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Often when one can't fully control some pattern in one's mind, it's definitely best to remove oneself from a public situation, because how it can play itself out there, because one hasn't got control of something, then one leaves that situation so you can at least vent it or work it out in private. That's definitely a good cautionary measure.
So they have a saying, people I can do without, you know. And you know, because Prabhupada says, I was reading, Naveen gave me this book, Prabhupada, different departments, and they were quarreling amongst themselves, and Prabhupada didn't like that, you know. Try to work cooperatively. So, and then also the temples are like a fishbowl. You know, you're running into the same people all the time, so you have to make it work. You know, you can't just, you know, go around and offending people. You know, so
Thank you, Jitendra.
In appreciation of your point, I forgot. Since Jitendra and Wang, I kind of forgot what your last point was, but it was something to the effect of when we're ignored, etc. This kind of glorification of Prabhupada, actually, which is always, nice to hear in Prabhupada's temple. So, but before I mention that, like, as far as ignoring, we see in the pastimes of the scriptures, there's so many people who committed offenses when they were ignored. Parikshit Maharaj was ignored by the sage. He put the snake around. But Prabhupada says in one purport that was actually orchestrated by the Lord for Parikshit Maharaj to commit that offense when he was ignored, actually. So, he has a pass on that, so it wasn't really offensive. It was orchestrated. Or Daksha was ignored by Shiva when Gajendra, in his previous life as a human being, he was just meditating, and he didn't see one king, and this king cursed him to become Gajendra. And Brahma was ignored by Brihu. So many passings where people come. So I always joke, when people ignore us, they actually, in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada quotes a verse that says, the spirit soul is 1/10,000th the upper portion of a hair. Not only that, you can't even see the spirit soul. So when people ignore us, they remind us of our constitutional position, because when we leave our body, nobody cares what we think. So you might as well practice it now, you know, because when you leave your body, nobody's going to care what you lose all upadis, including this big body. And just as in glorification of Prabhupada took a bhakti sastri test of being ignored for over 40 years when he first came to Krishna consciousness. You know, he was like, do you want to chant Hare Krishna? Get a job, old man. Get it, you know, etc. Or they'll ignore him, completely criticize or completely ignore him. And this went on for 40 years. So the Lord tested him, Prabhupada, do you have the outfit of a spiritualist? Determination. And he proved that actually he had the outfit and the infit, which was his determination. And so when one person ignores us, you know, we either leave the movement, you know, they're not devotees at this, or we'll criticize, waste our time. But look at Prabhupada, and that's why he's so glorious. And that's why in the Bible, my favorite verse where Jesus says, whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. And we see that's why Prabhupada and great saints like him are so exalted. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you for bringing in something from a different tradition, since it was touched on a little in the class. At least highlighting our founder, Acharya. Yeah, so. Oh, we'll have one more comment.
It's also said, from pride comes cruelty. So that kind of coincides with what he said. To be humbled. From pride comes cruelty.
That's Jitendra Prabhu, what you've touched on is the prior to the argument that I was presenting today of how Narada Muni was looking at things that preceded this, that it was actually somebody who was proud of their position that came to be particularly cruel, and he was making the connection with animal slaughter and pride. So indeed, that was the precursor to these two verses.
Great. The clarity of the subject matter depends on the person, not on the subject matter itself, because that's already clear. We don't see things as we are. We see things as we are.
Yes.
And we don't see reality. We see our perception of reality.
Correct. Correct. Yes. That's exactly the was the point of things.
That's
yes.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Krishna Samhita.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, that's precisely what was the emphasis in the class, that you know, whether you see, are you observing what you see, or you're observing with some knowledge. So yeah, thank you very much. Because it's late, I won't go further. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.